And with me on the phone, David Rubel.
Hi, Ann.
Hey, there you are.
Here I am.
And he is the author of The Bedside Baccalaureate, a handy daily cerebral primer to fill in the gaps, refresh your knowledge, and impress yourself and other intellectuals, which presumes, A, that you think you're an intellectual, and B, that you care about impressing others.
Well, I think we all like to think we're intellectuals. And to be more correct, I'm the editor of The Bedside Baccalaureate, because the project actually involved the good work of almost two dozen expert academics who provide the basic information that's in the book.
That's true, but you wrote two sections, I noticed.
That's true. I have some expertise myself.
So you're an American historian, I'm guessing.
That's correct.
From the stuff that you wrote. And so what made you write this book? I just thought the concept was really clever.
Oh, great. Well, as you know, there are a lot of books out there that purport to stimulate one's mind. And I find them really lacking for the most part, because I think they're really trivia books. They will take a subject and tell you about it in just one page. And while that is convenient in some ways, I find it's sort of like a diet cookie. It doesn't stick to your ribs. And I thought there was a need for a book that actually taught people something instead of just dropped a lot of names. And so what we did was, we went out and found academics who teach the kind of courses that everybody lines up for on registration day, because the material's really interesting, and also because the way they teach it is special. And we had them distill those courses into 18 single-page topics, sort of like lectures. And they then sent me some draft text, and I used my skills as a professional writer to rework what they had done, to work with them on different ways of expressing it, so that we could turn phraseology that might be overly academic in some ways into language that anybody could read. And the result are these 20 courses, each of which have 18 lectures, and they give you a way to understand the knowledge that's presented, sort of like having a bookcase for your book, so you can keep them in order. And I thought the result was great. And so, in fact, we've just finished the second volume.
Aha! I knew there was a sequel coming. In fact, that was one of my questions. So tell me about the difference between the first and the second volume. So what did you fix in the second volume? What did you do differently?
And well, actually, we didn't do anything differently other than choose different courses.
Okay.
Because as we were doing the first volume, we realized in choosing those courses that there was so much out there to choose from. Because the book couldn't be, 10,000 pages long, it's just 360 or so, we had to leave out certain courses, and a lot of those we picked up for the second volume. And what we've tried to do, Anne, is spread things out really over the whole breadth of knowledge. So there are social science courses, there are math courses, there are art history courses, there are English and comp lit courses, there are economics and philosophy courses. And there's just so much out there. There's so many good teachers out there who have things to tell us that we think this series can go on for quite a while.
I like the one called Rocket Science myself.
Oh, that's a great course. I learned a ton in that class. It was written by a guy who's a NASA physicist and also teaches at the University of Houston. Really interesting fellow. And he's actually a good example for why I think this format works so well. In his classes, he's worked out the best analogies to describe the complex physics that go into rockets. He's explained it to so many freshmen that he now knows how to present it in ways that people can understand. And he has this great model for thrust. He says, imagine a hunter with a rifle sitting on a sled on a frozen pond. And the idea is that there's very little friction on a frozen pond. And he says, if the hunter fires the rifle in one direction, the hunter and the sled will take off in the other direction. And that's an example of Newton's law of for every action,
there's an equal and opposite reaction. In fact,
and when he wrote that, it just sort of all came together for me, and I got the idea that the bullet has momentum in one direction. Its mass times its velocity, just like the gases that come out of a rocket engine have mass and velocity, and it's because they're going in one direction down that the rocket goes up.
Makes sense, doesn't it?
It makes a lot of sense when someone who knows about it explains it to you.
That's for sure. And how did you pick the people whose contributions you took?
Well, we did a lot of networking, and I was particularly advantaged in that because my parents are retired academics. They taught at Columbia for 30 years, and they know an awful lot of people, most of whom they would have lunch with. And so I could contact the chairs of pretty much every department at Columbia and say, here's the kind of project we're doing. Is there someone you could recommend? And sometimes they recommended people at Columbia, and there are a number of people from Columbia who contributed. But usually academics, as I'm sure you know, are connected all over the country. And they said, you know, I used to have a student who's now teaching at Notre Dame who'd be fabulous. And that's how we got the guy who wrote the Shakespeare course in the second volume. The fellow who wrote the Islam course in the first volume was a student of someone I knew from Columbia who now is a distinguished emerging scholar at Elon University in North Carolina. So we used a lot of personal connections, but even then sometimes we had a little bit of trouble finding someone who was well qualified to do the meteorology and climate course was a little tough. But we managed to find someone at Cornell because she had a website up in which she explained a lot of these concepts that we found, thought was great, and contacted her.
Cool. So who do you think is going to buy this book? Who is this book for?
Well, I know that I've been out of college for about 25 years now, and one of the things that I really miss about college myself is the breadth of knowledge that was available to me. You know, I had to take certain major requirements, but I could also take courses in kind of anything I wanted, especially as I got to be an upperclassman. And I think a lot of people miss that too. Most of the reading they do is related to their professional life for the most part, or they're reading some novels. They don't really have a chance to read a lot of nonfiction that can grow their understanding of the world. And I think that's particularly common with people as they enter middle age. And so I think among that group of people, people like me, who spend most of their time reading in one particular subject, the opportunity to read a really smart and authoritative but brief version of another subject is really appealing.
I agree. I'm really kind of liking this. I mean, you could just read a page or you could read a couple of pages. And I like the fact that it's a lot of information on one page.
Well, part of what we wanted to do was to allow people to pick it up and put it down. I think that a lot of the reason that people don't want to learn about relativity, for instance, is that they think, I just don't have the time to read a 400-page book on relativity. Well, if they pick up the Bedside Baccalaureate, they can read 18 pages. And while that's no substitute for the in-depth knowledge one can get from a larger work, in those 18 pages, and I know because I've gone over them really closely, you get a really good handle on relativity. Enough so that if you read a reference to it somewhere else, you'll know what that reference means. One of the courses in the book is globalization. And that's a subject that one hears about all the time on all the news shows. But rarely does anyone take the time to explain what globalization is really about. And the guy who wrote that course actually is a Turkish national who now teaches at Harvard. He has a really interesting perspective on world economics, and he explains what the basic institutions do, what the IMF does, what the World Bank does, and how globalization is conceived of by economists, so that when you hear someone like Ben Bernanke talking about globalization on the news, you can understand what he's saying in a much more sophisticated way.
Small things here. One of the things I liked is that you included a ribbon, a bookmark. I thought that was a very nice touch.
I have to compliment the publisher. That was their idea. They sprung for it. And it is really nice. It's not that often that one can find a nice hardcover book with a nice dust jacket and a silk ribbon stitched into it for under $20.
Absolutely. But not only that, for this kind of reading, it's really good to bookmark. Now, I have another question that kind of has to do with the bookmark.
Sure.
So you have these four curricula, and they're interleaved. Why are they interleaved? In other words, you do one page of one page of the next, one page of the next, one page, and then it repeats. And it's like, why aren't they all contiguous?
Well, I think one of the things that's appealing about books that have a lot of different subjects in them, sort of miscellanies is the name often given to them, is that the reading experience is more varied then. And what we decided to do was to break up the book to simulate, in some ways, the college experience.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to school, typically, you know, you don't take one course and then start another course. You've got the French Revolution on Monday, and you've got great works of art on Tuesday, and you have empiricism on Wednesday, and your day is sort of mixed up, and your week is mixed up. And so what we did was we divided the 20 courses into four different groups, and within those four groups, each of those five courses rotates. So that way you're not necessarily reading the same thing every day. You can switch off. But of course, it's so easy just to keep skipping those four pages in between if you want to read one course all the way through. But this way, if you do keep the book by your bedside, and we really mean that literally, we think it'll work really great there, you can pick it up, read one or two of the lectures for a night. They're self-contained, although they do build on each other, and your reading becomes more enjoyable, at least I think so, and it's not as much purely for gathering knowledge, but there's a pleasurable aspect to it as well.
I have to notice that there isn't a course on music.
We thought about that, Anne, but there's a real problem with offering a course on music in a book. You can't give examples.
Right. You'd have
and
to have
to say,
a CD.
It sounds like this, which is what professors do, and then they put on, well, when I was in college, they put on the record,
right,
the LP, but now I imagine they turn on their MP3 player.
Yes, they do.
And what we found was, after talking to a couple of musicologists, that really was a hurdle that we couldn't overcome.
You couldn't just give them a push the button and have an iTunes download that they could have to go along with it?
Perhaps that's possible, but I must admit I'm a technological laggard.
Ugh, terrible. No, but it seems to me that would help. It would help. And there are many things that can be done technologically. So it might be worth talking to the publisher about options they'd be open to.
Sure, but that would mean you'd have to have a computer by your bedside.
And there's something wrong with that? You remember we're in the Silicon Valley here. We all have computers.
There you go. Well,
actually,
I'm in upstate New York, and I don't have one at home.
So tell us a little bit about you and where you teach and all of that good stuff.
Well, actually, I am not an academic in that.
Really?
I do not have a university appointment. I'm a writer of American history. My last two books, one was on the Civil Rights Movement, which is, in fact, the course one of the two that I write in the Bedside Baccalaureate. It was called The Coming Free, and it was a history of the Civil Rights Movement dating all the way back to Reconstruction. And the one before that is a history of the United States, a single volume called The Story of America, that I co-wrote with Alan Weinstein, who is now the archivist of the United States.
Yeah, that's right. Very cool. Very cool. When is the next one slated to come out?
The next volume will be out in April. It's already at the printers.
Wow. Well, thank you so much. My guest, David Rubel, is there a website that people can go to find out more about the Bedside Baccalaureate?
The publisher maintains a website for it. It's part of their catalog website. But anyone who just Googles the Bedside Baccalaureate, all kinds of information pops up through the magic of the Internet.
Exactly. The Bedside Baccalaureate, a handy daily cerebral primer to fill in the gaps, refresh your knowledge, and impress yourself and other intellectuals. Edited by David Rubel and featuring the work of some very talented writers and, I guess, professors. Yes, things in the book. Well, General Grant's Civil War, Globalization, as you heard, the Hudson River School, which is about art, the Astronomical Universe, Myths of Ancient Greece and Rome, Emerson and Transcendentalism, the History of the Earth, Revolutionary France, the Search for Alternative Energies, Schools of Buddhist Thought, and it goes on from there. So that's just a snippet of the Bedside Baccalaureate. And thank you so much, David Rubel, for being my guest this morning.
Thanks for having me, Anne.
Hey, have a wonderful day, and best of luck with this and the next edition of the Bedside Baccalaureate.
Thanks very much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.